So welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 7. Before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working on Skrepakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrepak people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Our guest today is David Schaus, the proud owner and roaster of Six Beans Roasting, a new local family-owned coffee roasting business that serves Salmon Arm and the Shuswap with fresh roasted and even custom roasted coffee beans. You're going to learn some interesting things about coffee roasting today and about the long and winding road that David has followed to get into the coffee business. Welcome, David, to Food Conversations.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you here. And we're going to, I meant it when I said we're going to learn about coffee roasting, some stuff that I think a lot of listeners aren't really aware of. Now, speaking of long and winding roads, why don't you share with listeners how you, the precipitating moment when you started on this journey from being an established Tim Hortons coffee drinker to being a coffee roaster extraordinaire. So one day in a galaxy far, far away, which was actually in Salmon Arm, British Columbia, you were training a new employee with TELUS, and something happened that turned your taste buds around. Why don't you describe what happened on that day?
Right. So I'm going to change the name to protect the innocent, but we're going to call him Bud Jared. He'll know who he is if he's listening. And I was actually a contractor to TELUS at the time, and we were working in the northeast section of Salmon Arm. Like Warren had said, I was a religious Tim Hortons McDonald's coffee drinker. And if that's your thing, that's fine. It's subjective. It's okay. And my friend Jared, while we're on the site, mid installation of a fiber optic installation, he says to me, "Do you want to take a coffee break?" And what I thought that meant is, "Do you want to go get Tim Hortons or McDonald's?" Because as a Canadian, usually meant Tim Hortons.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, supposed to go get a double, get that coffee, lots of sugar, lots of cream. And he said, "No, I'll make you a coffee." And he opened the back of his truck, and he had a hand grinder there. He had water that he had kept hot in a Stanley thermos, and he had an AeroPress. For people that aren't familiar, an AeroPress is essentially a cylindrical tube that presses fairly fine ground coffee through a paper filter or a metal filter at the bottom into a cup. So you make a cup at a time. And he made me this cup of coffee, and it was like no other coffee I'd ever had. it had no cream, no sugar, and it was not dark roasted. It was a medium, maybe medium light roast. I could taste some nuttiness, some fruitiness, some sweetness that I had never tasted in coffee before. I just didn't even know this was possible.
The road to Damascus.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a journey. It's a bit of a journey from there. I'm not sure how far you want me to go, but essentially after that, I started looking into trying to repeat this process. And so I headed over to some local stores.
Here?
Yeah. I headed over to Askew's. Actually, it was Askew's in Armstrong, Askew's in Salmon Arm. And I found a pretty good selection of coffee at all those locations.
Right.
I found the same coffee. I actually would say the name because I'm not afraid to plug local because they are a BC roaster, but I can't remember it. I just remember the color was light blue. And I got the bag of coffee, took it home, drank it, made it the same way he made it, and it did not taste nearly as good.
Mm-hmm. What was the difference? Did it just didn't have the subtlety dull. Of the flavor?
It was dull. Yeah, it just wasn't as bright. It just, you know, when you have something that just really, you remember. I could probably drive somebody to that house in Salmon Arm that we were parked out front of because it was an experience that...
I think you're going to be a coffee roaster for the rest of your life. I think you just sealed it right
here.
Yeah. But and then you started to, you got a roaster.
Yeah, I got a roaster not that long after that, actually. Yeah. Due to the journey.
How do you do that? Where do you buy a coffee roaster?
Well, like I said to many customers at TELUS when I worked for them is Google it. So I started Googling it. I wanted to buy a roaster from a, not necessarily a small manufacturer of roasters, but a small, company selling them.
Okay.
And so I looked around. I did find a company in Alberta that sold roasters. I found the type I wanted. I already had at that point, 4 or 5 children. And my wife is from a very large family of 13 children.
Good Lord.
And so we had and they come over and they want coffee. And so we, right away, I knew I needed a roaster that I could roast more than 200 grams at a time. I wanted something I could roast a pound at a time.
Sure.
So I picked up a roaster. Ironically enough, the guy that owns that company that I bought the roaster from, his brother works here in Salmon Arm at First Baptist or Shuswap Community Church. So it was kind of funny. I made those connections later. So I supported somebody somewhat local too.
So how much did the roaster cost?
I got my first roaster. It was 1 pound. It came with 5 pounds of coffee. Of green coffee, of course, mm-hmm. and it was under $600, over five. I don't remember the exact amount.
Mm-hmm. Alberta is not known as a sort of a hotbed of coffee aficionados, but obviously, what you've probably learned over the years is that it's there's a lot of people who want good coffee.
That's
they don't
right.
want just plain old vanilla, as they say, coffee.
That's right.
So. You started to roast coffee because you had your own roaster, and you roasted some for friends and for family. What was the feedback they were giving you? You had this fairly profound experience when you had this cup of coffee. What were they saying to you?
I was getting really positive feedback early on. Coffee, of course, is subjective. You're always going to get the person that wants something flavored, possibly with chemicals, possible with other things. So you're always going to get people that aren't on the same journey and aren't going to have the same experience you're going to have with something, with any food. But by and large, extremely positive. And so I was getting requested all the time to roast coffee for people.
And what kind of things were they telling you? What did they say about the coffee you served them?
Right. Yeah. So some of the common things I would hear was, this coffee doesn't hurt my stomach. This coffee doesn't make me feel the same kind of crappy crash afterwards. Mm-hmm. Of course, all these claims are anecdotal, but it still has some value when people are telling you that more than one time.
Well, you mentioned when we were talking before the show about the oils in coffee that can oxidize, become rancid.
Right.
And that can be a problematic component of the coffee you're drinking.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So if you're seeing oil present on your beans when you buy a bag of coffee, it either means they're old. So they could be roasted a medium roast, but they could be old and then oils will start coming out over time.
Okay.
Or they could be a very dark roast. And some customers love that.
Mm.
So you can have a fresh roasted coffee that's very oily. But what happens is the oil present on the beans over time goes rancid. So even
so it
though...
it must be a polyunsaturated oil or...
Oh, yeah, that would be above me on that
one. Well, as a physician, I'm always talking to people about nutrition, and the oil is supposed to be good for your polyunsaturated, but as soon as you take them out of the bean or the source or the nut, they start to oxidize quickly. So it definitely happens, and when it happens, what does it make the flavor of the coffee change like?
You're going to start getting to more stale flavors, especially if it's the oil present from it being old. Well, the flavor profile is going to be different because the bean is going to be older.
Right.
But it just, it causes oxidization, turns rancid. It's well known. It's getting to be more and more well known that older coffee is actually not as good for you, just like anything.
Sure. Of course. Now, at this point, you weren't thinking of a business because starting up a business of any sort is a challenge.
Right.
But you had been working for a number of years.
Right.
Interestingly, at Dairy Queen, you and your brother, did you ever drink the Dairy Queen coffee?
You know what? I never did. I was 15 years old. I never drank the coffee there. I started drinking coffee shortly after I left Dairy Queen, but I never drank that stuff. I've heard it's not great though.
And you worked also in construction?
I worked construction from about 2005 to 2009.
Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff were you doing there?
I was mostly doing finished stuff.
Okay.
So I worked for a local contractor, a few different local contractors, and I always found myself doing the higher detail sort of stuff, siding, finished carpentry, hanging doors, installing cabinets, that sort of stuff.
Good experience, because that's the stuff that takes a long time and demands attention.
Yes, that's right.
As opposed to the framing.
Yeah.
And you also worked for TELUS, as
you
mentioned earlier. How long were you with TELUS?
So I was what TELUS would call a partner to TELUS. What other TELUS employees would call a contractor to TELUS.
Yes.
So I worked for a company called Ledcor,
and
I worked for them from 2010 to 2015 in January.
Now, working in different fields, if you like, gives you an idea of what the general state of working both for yourself, but also what you work when you're working for somebody else. Can you think of any skills that sort of transferred from those work experiences to what you later did, which is to start up your own company?
Right. Well, I think some of the skills I learned as an in-home technician, both as a contractor and right for what I call the mothership of TELUS,
right.
I learned very good how to interact with different types of people.
Sure.
Because you're in 5 to 8 houses a day if you're working hard and fast. And so you're meeting different people all the time. So that skill will never go to waste, no matter what you move on to do next. And so that's helped me, I would say, at markets and whatnot.
The other thing that was interesting when you're talking about is that you were homeschooled.
Right.
You had 3 years in the public school system, and then your parents said, okay, you're going to come home and learn.
Correct.
And I think you told me you never actually found out what had happened to change their mind.
I was just glad to be going home, to be honest.
What was different about being homeschooled? I mean, I have relatives who homeschool their kids, and it's a different experience. What do you remember that doing in terms of your way of looking at the world and yourself?
Right. Well, there's a massive spectrum of homeschoolers, right? You're going to have every different type that do it in different ways. But the way we are always taught to do it is school isn't just in a book. You know, if you're fishing with your dad and you come home and you learn to clean the fish and you learn how the fish is built and you look in its stomach and you see what it's been eating and all that, that is school. Mm-hmm. If you go hunting with your parents or your uncle or aunt and you do the same thing with an animal, same idea, mm-hmm. that is school, right? So school was never confined growing up to just being sitting very specifically for a certain period of time.
Right.
And it was very goal oriented. So it would be like, when you're done this, if you want to have a job on the side, go have a job on the side. So
you said something like you, the person, were responsible to get yourself going.
That's right.
It's not just somebody tells you what to do next.
Right.
You would come up with your own ideas. Who was your teacher at home?
Well, it was mostly my mom, actually.
Yeah,
it was mostly my mom. My mom actually was a school teacher in Ontario before I was born. so my mom would, she was very organized, and she would have her set amount that we had to do that week. She'd plan it out every week.
One of the things you mentioned to me was that your dad was in real estate, and at one point he got you working for him. What did he get you doing on the phone?
Well, he had me doing many things, but the thing that was the most uncomfortable, it's not dissimilar to the memory with drinking that first good cup of coffee, because I still can remember the computer I was sitting at and the office I was sitting in. Imagine the old Dell big, huge screens, right?
Yeah.
This is probably 1998. I was 14 years old.
And the anxiety?
Yeah, some anxiety. And I grew up in a little town called High River, Alberta, and I pulled up the High River Times. And my dad showed me the FISBOs. And I said, what's a FISBO? And he said, it's for sale by owners. And I was like, this, I don't like where this is going. And so people that are opting to list their home on their own without the help of a realtor, he said, I want you to call a list of them. And I don't remember whether he said 5 or 10 or if he just said call the whole paper.
Till you collapse.
Yeah. Yeah. So needless to say, I think most of us, if a 14 to 16 year old person called you to offer to list your home, you're probably going to say no, but it taught me some valuable skills about doing some things that make you uncomfortable.
And what it's like when somebody says no,
yeah,
right to your face.
Yeah. You have to hear no from somebody besides your parents at a young age, I believe strongly. And as a homeschooler, I think that's actually even more important.
Well, yes. And as a homeschool kid, you're dealing with adults who you know, and they know you. So it's not like they give you some suggestion that has nothing to do with you. It's like you're interacting in a very much more
relational.
Yeah, exactly. Now, High River, High River has been in the news in the last few years. It was a very nice place to live when you were there. What was it like? What was the environment that you were in when you were living there?
In 1992, my parents bought 5 acres. A 2-year-old house for $125,000 on a tributary of the river. And the first day we looked at this property, I would have been 8 years old. And I remember my parents looking at the house and me being an 8-year-old boy having zero interest in the house. And I was looking at this tributary from the Highwood River, and I watched a sucker fish get engulfed by a Maganzer duck. It swam down, it caught it, it ate the entire fish on the lawn. And I just remember thinking, I never want to leave this place. Some of those feelings change once your house is underwater, though.
Yes. And that's, you were, There was a mark. There was a stake.
Right.
And
right.
You were told by the locals, when the water hits that stake, time to move out.
Right. So it was actually a very specific event the stake got driven in for. So in 1995, in June, around the beginning of June, the waters were rising very fast. Me and my siblings were in a swim team, and we were at swim. And before we went to our swim practice, the local, I think it was a fisheries biologist, but I don't know for sure. Came out and he took a what was like a sharpened 2x4, drove it into the middle of the lawn and said to my dad, when it gets there, you leave and you probably have less than 24 hours, but maybe more. And we got back less than 2 hours later and it was past that stake.
Mm.
And it was very frightening loading all, you know, I think there was 6 to 10 of us still at home then. I don't know how many kids were at home at that time.
Mm.
And we all loaded into the big van and stayed with friends for the whole summer. Basically, we never went back until September because it took that long for them to get the house livable again after the waters.
So it was significantly flooded, your house?
Significantly flooded, yeah. So, and it led to my dad's health demise, I believe. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? That's unfortunate. Your house would have been level on grade?
Right. There was no basement.
There were no basements in High River.
No, not on the river. There is some on the east side, but not on the west side.
That can be a bit of a life-changing experience. You know, you're seeing Mother Nature doing what she wants to do, and
that's
nobody
right.
can argue with her.
Yep.
I'd remind listeners again that I'm talking with David Schaus, by the way, who's the proud owner and roaster, chief roaster, of Six Beans Roasting, a coffee business here in Salmon Arm. Now, at some point, I guess your father decided maybe we should be living in some other place? Was it the flood that really pushed him, or it was just...
I don't think it was the flood, because the beauty was so great in between the flood years.
Mm.
So 95, the house was flooded. 98, the property was flooded. And in 2001, the property was flooded. And so even though the house never got wet, the properties, it was always just such a mess.
Yeah.
So it wasn't all those things. But my dad's health was deteriorating quick. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he was about 49 years old,
which is pretty young.
I grew to understand that was very young. Yeah. Yeah. So I became my dad's basically everything. Help. Yeah. I was his chauffeur. I right. helped him sell real estate. I just was with him all the time.
Right. And then he started looking for places.
Right. So my father-in-law, who lives in the area still, him and my dad basically got talking, saying, why do we live here exactly? Yeah, it's beautiful at certain times of the year, but there's a lot of the times of the year.
It's scary.
It's frightening. It's not as beautiful. It's windy a lot. The weather's not always fantastic.
Yeah.
And so they started looking around, and at one point they drove through Salmon Arm on some of their journeys. And my dad called my mom, and I still remember mom taking the call. It was late February, early March, not that different than now. And they were sitting on the patio at a restaurant downtown, and there were some crocuses starting to come up. Well, the idea of seeing flowers in southern Alberta till before May is very rare, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was huge to my dad. And then he loved the trees and the lakes. It reminded him of where he grew up in Ontario, in Lake Country, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we never really looked back as a family. We knew at that point. And within 8 months, we were here fully settled here. So,
and what kind of, obviously you had to get a place to live. What kind of place did you find out here?
We rented a place on 50th Street up in Glen Eden for the first few years. My dad's Parkinson's was deteriorating really fast. And so the idea of buying a place and anything like that, it was just kind of like, how do we keep dad comfortable and how do we have enough money for, you know, medications and stuff
like that. It's a very unpleasant illness. It takes away so much one step after another.
That's right.
Now at this point you had 6 kids, and I think it's safe for us to reveal the secret of the company's name.
Yeah.
Six Beans refers to your children.
That's right.
Six children.
Yep.
Who came up with that idea? And I also noticed the logo on your website. It's six coffee beans with little legs coming out.
That's right. That's right.
So who designed the logo?
So my niece, actually, in Alberta, who's a very gifted artist, she designed the logo for us.
It's a very sweet little.
Yeah. We wanted to. I got to be fully honest. I was fighting a little bit that brand, just because it's fun and family like, but I didn't know for sure that was my target audience.
Mm.
But one thing my wife and I, Jordan, decided to do early on is we really wanted our business to be fully authentic. I didn't want to try to be somebody I wasn't. I didn't want to try to sell coffee that I didn't like. I didn't want to be unapproachable ever. So the brand, it was important for the brand to be who we were, mm-hmm. but also be what I like the future, what I want the sure. future of the brand to be.
Yeah. So you're sort of thinking about it, but there's something daunting about starting up a business, your very own business, after you've been working in other people's businesses for a while.
Right.
What turned the corner for you? What made it seem like this was something we would do? We meaning the whole family.
Right. So in 2022, February, we're kind of still feeling like we're in the middle of COVID. The world around us was changing a lot. Like I was like, oh, this world that we think is a certain way can change very quickly. And it can change on a dime. Mm-hmm. And so that had an influence on it. I felt the move in telecommunication world away from long tenured, really experienced technicians to more like plug and play type stuff.
For
have
sure.
this as pre-thought out as possible. Right. Make it so it's very simple to teach somebody new. It was getting less interesting for that reason for me. Mm-hmm. So I knew I kind of wanted to exit mm-hmm. out of that world. I also wanted to do something that I was passionate about, and that I could do. I don't have the greatest joint system in my body. I have issues with knees and ankles and elbows and lately a hip. So I knew I didn't want to go back into the construction field full time, and I loved coffee. And so we looked at our finances and we looked at the direction TELUS was going, and we looked at the direction our family's a little bit older now. Our youngest, we don't have diapers anymore. We don't need a babysitter every time we want to go anywhere. And we decided to, just buy a really simple little roaster to get started, bigger commercial roaster.
You had also had a connection with Colombia.
That's right.
Wasn't directly part of this process, but it was indirectly very much
totally.
Part of the process. So why don't you describe what that was about? It was sort of family, new people.
Right. So 2019, my brother-in-law, also David, in Edmonton area, he was getting married to a Colombian girl that he had met a few years before. And there was a wedding in November in, I believe, Spruce Grove. Well, I don't want to go to Spruce Grove in November. To be honest, I don't know if I ever want to go there. I like Salmon Arm.
But you do have a distributor there for your coffee.
Yeah, we do have a little Mexican bakery that sells our coffee there. Yeah, that's right. And so my wife, I said, why don't you go to the wedding in Spruce Grove? And I'll go to they were going to have a Colombian wedding, which was going to be far more fun because it's in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And
lots of dancing and
yeah, there
on.
Was lots of dancing.
Singing.
Yeah, in February. And so I said, why don't we plan right now? I'll book the time off. I was still working for TELUS and we'll go to Colombia. And I said, and also let's see if Danny, my new sister-in-law at the time, her dad can help us find some fresh green coffee that I can bring back and roast. I still had no idea I was going down the commercial road at this
point.
Yeah.
What were you thinking then at that time? You just wanted to get really good coffee from a source that's well known?
Even early on, I wanted traceability in my coffee.
Mm.
And so what's more traceable than actually going to the farm and meeting the actual farmer, not necessarily the farm owner, because I'm not all that concerned about the guy that owns the farm unless he's also the farmer. I'm more curious about the guy that's living on this
hands
farm.
Hands-on.
Yeah, hands-on. I wanted to see how it was done. I wanted to see how they were treated.
Right.
And so that was a big part of the process. I also really liked Colombian coffee. And I said to you in our conversation the other night that I just love trying new things as well. And so I wanted to make sure that I got to try some new coffee from somebody I met and see how they were being treated.
So what is it about Colombian coffee that's special?
I don't know that Colombian coffee is that much more special than other coffees, to be honest. Mm. Every region has things about it that has some, like there's some great coffees from all over Central and South America and Africa. But Colombia is obviously, I think it's either the second largest or largest coffee producer still. I believe Brazil might be overtaking them now on that one, but I still believe Colombia is. It's you cannot get away from coffee culture if you go to Medellin.
It's kind of iconic. I remember there was some cheesy ads from Nescafe with Juan Valdez.
Right.
Didn't look like anybody that probably lives there, but it looked like our fantasy of what a coffee grower would be like.
Yeah.
But there was real coffee. So you got some coffee.
Right.
You managed to find your way to a finca, which is the Spanish word for a farm.
Yeah.
And you got some coffee.
Right. Yeah, so the coffee had already been processed because that's a period. So I knew I had this coffee, so I said, take me to the farm where it was grown, and I wanna meet the farmer. So we got in our little tiny rental car and drove up the side of this muddy road on the side of outside of Medellin in an area. I'm probably gonna butcher the pronunciation, but Jericho, I believe. Looked like Jericho if you pronounce it with an English accent.
Yeah,
had to go. And it was up this hillside, and when we got there, I just noticed right away that this farmer, he wasn't living what we would call a rich, lavish lifestyle, but he had everything he needed. He had chickens there. He had eggs. He had a dairy cow, lots of coffee, lots of fruit growing on his property. His kids were outside playing. Like, it looked, from a Western culture, that looked like a desirable lifestyle.
Well, it's also a lifestyle that we're realizing is very valuable for us to live. It's right. Good for us emotionally. It's good for us spiritually. It's good for us in terms of how we take care of the planet.
That's right.
If you don't have to travel millions of miles to get the stuff you need.
Yeah, the mangoes are rolling down the road there. So
so you got some coffee. How much did you get?
I got 50 pounds.
Yes.
I brought an extra suitcase with, that was my coffee suitcase.
Your coffee case.
Yeah, it was a hard-shelled, bright red suitcase that I knew I could put 50 pounds in there.
And it wouldn't break it.
Yeah, it wouldn't break it. And so my plan was to bring back 50 pounds of Colombian coffee that had been harvested that year and meet the farm. So that was all accomplished. The way home was a little bit adventurous. Our flight went from Medellin to Bogota, from Bogota to Houston. So we made it from Medellin to Bogota, no problem. We're waiting.
US of A.
Yeah, we're waiting for our flight from Bogota to Houston now. And I hear, we're in Bogota, and it was in Spanish, but I heard my name. And I knew enough that they were wanting me to come down.
For a chat.
Down the gangplank towards the plane, right? That's where it was, kind of where you might see the bags, that like the strollers sitting and whatnot. And I saw my suitcase there. I said to Jordan, my wife, I said, this is going to be about the coffee. And so there's three or four Colombian men there. And they said, you know, what's in this suitcase in broken English? I said, oh, it's coffee. But to give you the audience a picture, it's 5 kilo like squares or packed tightly with burlap and shrink wrap around them. So it looks an awful lot like something else I might be bringing back.
Yes, indeed. Medellin is quite well known for other things besides coffee.
Yeah.
Remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with David Schaus, who's the owner and roaster for Six Beans Roasting. So there you are in the airport.
Yeah.
Face to face with several gentlemen who may or may not be friendly.
It didn't feel friendly, but it might have been on me and more on them.
And so what happened?
So they basically said, what's in the case, like I said, and I told them it was coffee. I already described how it was packaged, so it could have, you know, I could see why they were concerned, right? Mm-hmm. They had right to be concerned.
Absolutely.
So they said, open the suitcase. I opened the suitcase, and one of them grabbed a sack and just put his nose right against it, smelt it, and said, yeah, it's coffee, dropped it back in the bin, and I was on my way.
You're on your way.
Yeah, and then a little bit more to that story, Warren, which I forgot to tell you the other night, was in Houston, we had a bag go missing, and I said to my wife, it's going to be the coffee for sure. It wasn't. It was a random other suitcase. It's just kind of funny, but I thought for sure the coffee wasn't making it, but I got back with the coffee
in
the same day.
There you are. Well, it just goes to show here you are in a country that's publicly notorious for the drug industry,
right?
And you're going down to get coffee, and the whole world is likely to think that you have something else in your mind.
Yep.
So you had your bags of coffee, you brought it back to this part of the world, and you started to roast. But this was not, this was at this stage still for yourself, your friends, your family, etc.
Correct.
But then, as you said earlier, you really got serious about this being a business. You looked at your finances, did all the things you have to do to make sure. Did you have any business advice from here? Because at this point, you're on your own. You're right.
So here being Canada, yes.
Yeah.
I'll circle back to the salmon arm portion of the support I've had. But one of the things I was encouraged to do, and I don't even remember who by, was to find somebody that has done what you want to do. And reach out to them, right? So when you started a radio station, probably easier to find somebody who's doing the same thing and get advice. So I went on the internet, and I found a roaster out of Ottawa, Ontario. He'd only been around for a few years. He survived COVID, and if anything, he thrived during COVID. He did very well because he was adaptable and adjustable. He roasted on the same brand of machine I was using at that time. So we had a camaraderie around mm-hmm. the type of roasting we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And his business model was similar. Simple, fresh roasted coffee, direct to consumers a lot of the time.
And small scale. He wasn't.
Small scale. He was not a big boy. At this yeah. point, I think he did have a few point people working for him already, mm-hmm. though. So he had grown a little bit. And so he was so gracious. And we had a phone, FaceTime type call. And his encouragement to me was that everybody in the world basically drinks what you're trying to sell, right? Very high percentage of people consume coffee.
Right.
You don't need 80% of your town to drink your coffee. In fact, you probably can't even supply coffee for 80% of your town, even a smaller town. I just need 10 to 20% of people to really like my coffee and be willing to buy it locally here. And I've got a very good business.
Sure.
So that was his encouragement to me. And that really just changed the way I thought about it and made me realize that this is truly possible. And this was after I had already bought my little commercial roaster.
Mm. So the transition, how do you go about a transition where you're starting up a business like that? You tell people.
Right. Yeah, so I knew
you get that nifty little logo that you weren't sure about.
Yeah, we got that fairly quickly. And if you look at, if people peruse our older Instagram feeds, our bags were pretty ugly because at the beginning I was designing the labels myself. I was trying to keep everything just as low cost as possible. Quickly, I realized that there's people that are far more skilled at things than I am, and they don't charge all that much because they're so much more efficient. So we've moved away from that, luckily. but I knew I couldn't quit my day job. I knew I had to provide for our family because I'm the sole provider as far as money goes. Yeah, I like to be careful. My wife does an awful lot, and I never want to degrade what she does because she is far busier than I am most days. But as far as paying the bills, I had to bring that money in. That was my job. And so I knew I couldn't quit my day job. And so what we did is we started roasting on this new roaster. And to back up a little bit to the old roaster, I roasted with no technology on the old roaster. It was sight, sound, and smell, and of course taste at the end.
Right.
So I learned how the beans developed in the roaster. I learned what they smelt like at certain stages. I learned the difference between different types of green coffee going in, the smell it would produce, what that ended up ultimately tasting like. And so when I got my big roaster, I wanted everybody to be trying it as quickly as possible. So we go to a local church and I offered people coffee at just barely above my cost. Like the goal was not to make any money on this coffee. Do some field testing. And that's the best thing about the farmer's market too, by the way.
Yes.
Is you meet your customers and they come talk to you. They look you in the eye and they tell you, and a lot of them are very honest.
Yeah.
You know, they'll tell you what they love or what they don't love or whatever. And so we rely on that. And it's not an offense if somebody says, hey, can you do it a little different? I didn't like this. And because we want customers to love our coffee.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I got everybody tasting the coffee as much as possible.
When did you know that it was time to take the plunge and say, okay, my auxiliary employment medium is going to be sacrificed
because
I got the real one lined up?
Right. So the goal was, there's a radio show out of the States, and he's a money guy, and he always says, when you're starting a side business, pull the boat to the dock before you try to jump in. Like, don't try to jump into that entrepreneurial boat when it's so far away from the dock and you have no idea if it's going to provide for your family or for your needs or not. So the business had been growing quickly. We had started at the Sorrento Farmers Market in summer of 2022. And it went really well. Really good support. And we've always were being encouraged to do the Salmon Arm Farmers Market. But we were a little bit leery because we knew it was busier and we were just learning a lot of stuff like really fast. And so we kept getting encouraged. So we jumped into the Salmon Arm Farmers Market spring of 2023. And we were just blown away by the support. Like the first week we sold out of everything. And it was just the support at that market has been fabulous. So the business is growing. It's going well. But it's still not the profit levels I need it to be just to pay the bills. Not looking to get rich. Just want to keep living the way we're living. Yeah.
So now that we're talking about, you know, doing it on a significant scale, why don't we kind of go through the process that, first of all, you've got a pretty skookum and up to date modern and appropriate for the 21st century roaster. Why don't you describe your roaster, your electric-powered fluid bed coffee roaster hot air. I said it.
You got all the terms, yeah. Well, as we know, no matter what one thinks about it, we are moving away from fossil fuels at a fairly rapid pace, particularly in the Western culture and in mm-hmm. BC. And so I wasn't interested in trying to fight that. I wasn't interested in trying to get a traditional gas roaster. Gas roasters are 95% of the world's coffee would be roasted on a gas roaster. And the truth of the matter is, at some point, if I do get big enough, I probably will need to get some variation of a gas roaster. Mm. There is very efficient ones as well.
Sure.
But I want it to be a home-based business for as long as possible, mm-hmm. Until I grow out of that space. And so an electric roaster made the most sense. And there's a company where they're manufactured in the United States, in Idaho. I can talk to the guy who builds them. And I could, if I need parts. And so I got an all electric, fluid bed roaster. And what fluid bed means is it is, 80% of the roasting of the beans is done through convection, not through conduction.
Okay.
So whereas traditional drum roasting is just the opposite.
So it's the air, the hot air that
hot
does,
air.
Does,
yeah.
does the roasting.
If everybody knows what a hot air popcorn popper looks like, just imagine a 60 amp hot air popcorn popper. 220 volts.
Fairly significant volume.
Yeah.
So how many pounds of coffee go into a roast?
Right. So my roaster is a 10-pound coffee roaster, which is, in the commercial coffee roasting world, very small. That is a very small roaster in the commercial coffee roasting.
What size would a commercial one be?
They call them full bag roasters. So 60, 70 kilo.
Okay.
So they would drop a full bag of green coffee in at the top, and that would be most... larger commercial roasters. I think the ones locally here, the other local coffee roasters, I think they're probably more like 10 or 15 kilo. So still a fair bit bigger than mine, but not
huge.
No, artisan roasters rarely roast on a full bag roaster.
And is there a reason for that? You can control it better?
It's easier to experiment and come up with what you want when you're not playing around with a full bag of coffee.
Right.
I mean, we all sample roast as well, right down to 200 grams to taste kind of what this bean is going to produce for us. Cost is a big reason why, if you're not selling an awful lot of coffee, that's a big piece of equipment to have.
Sure. You put the beans into the roaster.
Yep.
And then what happens?
Plug
the switch.
Yeah. So on my roaster, the first thing you do is you turn the exhaust fan on just to make sure you're not going to have any smoke or chaff coming into the house.
Sure.
People often ask me, what does the house smell like when you're roasting coffee? It doesn't smell like anything. It's just louder in the one room.
So it blows it out.
It blows it out. Yep. So the mostly just hot air is going out at the beginning. You adjust the loft, which means the beans are never sitting still, fluidized. They're always moving in there. If you have still beans and a lot of heat, you have fire. So you don't want to do that. So
you get some beans that are much different from other beans.
Right. Yeah. The density of the beans can vary a little bit. Although modern production methods, they don't vary much.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you keep the beans moving and then you start adding heat to it. Within about 4 to 6 minutes, I would say, you're completely through what we call the browning phase. So the beans are going from like a green color to a brown color.
Mm.
From that browning phase, that's where a lot of the sweetness is developed. So depending on what you do in that stage makes a big difference in the end cup.
Longer, sweeter, shorter...
Longer, sweeter.
Okay.
Yeah, within reason.
Pure guesswork on my part.
Yeah, pure guesswork, but you nailed it. Yeah, longer, sweeter. It's just going to develop that bean
And also,
more.
They must be losing moisture as well.
Of course, yeah. Lots of steam coming off them at this time. They're basically dry when they're brown. So if they're green, they've still got moisture in them. They get brown, and then they're around that 300 degree Fahrenheit mark, and that's when they're brown. And then at 400 degrees Fahrenheit, they're starting to pop a lot like popcorn. Crack, 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 crack.
They split.
They split open, yeah.
It's because I learned that from your logo.
Yeah.
They split. All the beans are split.
Yeah.
How do you look at them? Do you smell?
Yes.
You said you can't smell much because it's all going outdoors.
No, you can still get your face right in there and do one of these. Yeah. Yeah. You can brush, you can wave it into your face and smell it for sure. Yeah. It's all part of it. That's when I was very grateful for my beginning in my roasting. I didn't go out and just spend money on a commercial roast. I'm going to do this because I like coffee.
Mm.
I had actually roasted hundreds and hundreds of pounds on this little tiny countertop roaster that didn't have an exhaust system. So the house did smell
like coffee.
Yeah, it smelled like roasting coffee. Yeah.
When I was a kid in Vancouver, there were no shopping centers. So all the commercial business was downtown in Vancouver.
Right.
And driving along Robson Street, I believe it was, there was a coffee roasting building. I didn't know where it was. All I knew that when you drove along there, you could smell roasting coffee.
What years was this?
Oh, I'll tell you perilously, it was in the 60s.
Okay, okay.
Or actually, probably in the 50s.
Okay.
Okay, listeners, you didn't hear any of that. Yeah, it was beautiful. I remember it being just the most gorgeous smell. Can we just drive along here a little bit longer, mom?
Yeah, so. It's some people really enjoy it. I've had lots of my neighbors tell me they really like it, for sure.
Yeah, they come over and say,
yeah. They know when to order fresh coffee because they can smell it a little bit.
So what are you looking, how do you see the beans? I mean, is it kind of a mesh that you can look through?
You're looking through the top. You can open the exhaust fan. Like if you're doing a small enough load, you can actually open the fan and look right down in on this cylindrical holder for them where they're moving around. Sometimes I'll take a steel spoon and scoop them out if I'm curious to see more accurately.
Now your machine doesn't include the chaff. I read that on your website.
Right.
So what's that all about?
Yeah. So all machines attempt to get all the chaff out. So let's just be clear on that. Even drum roasters, they attempt to get the chaff out. Mm. But the chaff is, as the bean's breaking open, a lot of chaff is coming out. So around 380 degrees Fahrenheit, the bean is really close to cracking and it's doing a lot of moving and you're getting a lot of chaff. So I have a chaff collector, which is just a mesh bag.
So does the chaff sort of fly around? Does it sort of deposit itself in this bag that you've got there?
Yeah, because there's so much air.
Yeah.
You're hitting it with hot air from the bottom.
Right.
And then there's also a larger exhaust fan pulling all that hot air out. That sucks the chaff off the bean as soon as it becomes free-floating. So it leaves very quickly.
So the chaff is what, the shell?
Yeah, it's essentially the shell. Like if you think of even sometimes you get a certain kernels of rice where you can get the little bit of chaff coming off of it or different grains. It's not dissimilar to that.
And just for a visual for our listeners, does it rotate on a vertical axis or a horizontal axis?
The coffee beans as they're roasting?
The machine that's turning them.
No, the machine is actually stationary. It's just hot air.
Oh.
And just the hot air is moving the beans. The shape of the cylindrical hopper causes the hot air and the beans to go around.
So it must be a fairly skookum air.
Yeah, it's got it's a lot of air. Yeah.
that's why you have the vent outside.
That's right. Otherwise, and I do wear a hearing. I had a friend who been a friend for 20 years. And probably 80% of the people listening would know their family. And he came in and he said, "Where's your hearing protection?"
Yes.
"You're going to get tinnitus." And I got hearing protection right after that. So when kids come in the room to help me roast, they have their little hearing protection and I have mine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you've got them brown. The chaff has come off. What's happening next?
Yeah. So the next stage would be first crack. And that's what starts the development stage. So pre-first crack, by and large, the coffee drinking community would say that's undrinkable coffee. It's not going to taste like coffee. Mm. There is people that use it for different things, but generally speaking, coffee drinkers don't want it pre-first crack. After first crack, you're starting to develop some of the more familiar coffee flavors. So I like my coffee end of first crack. So meaning the first crack is stopping. That's when I like it.
Mm.
But what I've found is most coffee drinkers like it a little further than that. So,
and as it goes further, how does it change?
So the bean is getting darker in appearance. Mm. You're getting less sourness. So if you have it, if you pull the roast, say middle of first crack, say 30 seconds in, 410 degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to be a sour cup of coffee. But you're also going to have, when it cools down a little bit, you're going to taste the origin of that bean way more. So if you have a really high quality green coffee going in and you pull it at a lighter medium roast, you're going to start tasting, on some of my coffee bags, you'll see tasting notes of bubble gum.
I was reading blueberry. That. I was reading that chocolate, blackberry, peach, cocoa, almond, strawberry, grape, caramel. Sounds like a wine tasting contest.
Well, and you know, I say to a lot of people at the market, most of my coffee tastes an awful lot like coffee. You know, people who have been paid a lot more than me and who have very, very fine palates is determined that these beans will taste like this. There are a few of my coffees that I do have that are very fruity. I have one. I named it Juicy Beans just to make sure people knew about it. And that one legitimately does have fruity notes to it. But what produces the fruity notes is actually a lot to do with the way it's processed before you ever get it.
Mm-hmm. So you have this process where you're watching carefully to see how far it's advanced beyond the cracking stage.
Yeah.
is it getting lighter, then medium, then dark? And each batch is unified, right?
You
get only one batch, one kind of coffee out of one batch.
That's right. I do pre-blend some of my coffees, mm-hmm. which is a bit of a controversial subject, but I think I said on our previous call that I'm all about what people taste mm-hmm. and if they like it. I don't really care all that much back here about the science because coffee is not medicine. It's a drink. Enjoy it. It's not.
Some people in my practice think coffee is medicine, yeah, but I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
Yeah. So, but if somebody drinks a batch of coffee that's not perfectly roasted mm-hmm. and they don't love it, it's not going to kill them. So I like to change and just try things because I'm very pragmatic in my approach to coffee roasting. Mm.
So now you've got the coffee coming out of the other end.
Yep.
Do you have to cool it off?
Oh, yeah. The goal is to get it to touchable within less than 2 minutes. So the same large fan that's taking all the heat out, if you imagine dumping the beans directly to the right of the roaster, and then it's a mesh bottom, and then there's a 5-inch duct underneath that, which then sucks all the hot air down and out. And then
it sucks the air down. Yeah. And so room air is what cools them?
Yeah. The downdraft from the room sucks in. And within a minute, you can touch them. And within 2 minutes, they're ready to be dumped through a stone collector, actually, to make sure that you're de-stoning your beans.
De-stoning sounds like the opposite of stoning.
Right. Yeah. There's always a chance that you get little bits of rock in there mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. a lot of these, depending on the country and the washing station and the processing station within that country, they may be dried on concrete or they may be dried in even with little bits of gravel. Very, very rare. So I think I have 15 stones from 2 years of roasting. Like, it's very rare, but a stone can do a number on a high-end coffee grinder.
What? Okay, the grinder. Yeah. The grinder is where...
You probably wouldn't even taste it, to tell you the truth, but it could
little
rock
bits
a grinder.
Of teeth from the grinder
in
your coffee. So you've got your coffee. It's cool. Does it get bagged?
Yeah, so...
at that point. Yeah.
So we encourage reusing containers as much as possible. So we're a partner with Choose Refill here in town, and people can refill their containers. Sweet Leaf Bakery and Cafe in Piccadilly Mall, they reuse containers. So I bring it into them in food grade pails. They use the beans. I take the pails back. I wash them, sanitize them, fill them back up, bring them back to them.
There's a bit of a campaign about so-called single-use plastic.
Right.
But frankly, just about everything that we consume, produce, sell, buy. Right. It's a single-use plastic. Every step we take in that direction has got to be a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at the list of... this is where I found out that you had an outlet in Spruce Grove.
Right.
Dulce, Mexico.
Yeah.
And then one in Vernon. And then Cherryville.
Yeah.
One in Cherryville. And then the local ones that everybody knows about, like Grassroot Dairies. I mean, they make the milk to put in your coffee. In your milk. Shushrub Health Foods, Buckerfields. Buckerfield, that's interesting.
They've been awesome.
Yeah.
It just wasn't somewhere I would have ever approached.
Well, you tell me how it happened, because I wouldn't have thought of it either.
So my general rule with a retail partner is I would like them to be okay with small volumes, because I want it to be fresh. I don't want it old there. And sometimes it does. I mean, you can't control everything, but my goal would be that it's moving quickly enough, so small production. But Buckerfield's just approached me. Mm. My wife had done one of their Christmas time markets there for, I think it was geared towards women. And she had done it and kind of met the people. And one of their staff members sells soaps and whatnot at farmers market. So we met them and they just said, hey, we'd like to carry your coffee. And I said, well, sure, if you want to. And
obviously, if you're you want coffee to move quickly, then you bring some in, and then you have to be ready to replace it, because if it's not a large amount, it's going to sit in the shelf.
Yeah.
So do a lot of running around?
I try to keep it combined onto certain days. But one of the things that when you become a coffee roaster is that, you know, people want their coffee and they don't really like waiting for it. And so I try to be as flexible as I can at this stage. Yeah.
I'm going to remind listeners again that I'm talking with David Schaus, who's the proud owner and roaster of Six Beans Roasting. Now, you have these six beans, six children, six humans.
Yeah.
What's their involvement with the process?
Well, you know, when you have children ages from 6 years old to almost 16-year-old, there's obviously a lot of variableness there.
There is.
Yeah. So my older two boys are working more and playing more with their friends and doing school and whatnot. But my kind of the middle batch are very helpful. So Andrew is 11 years old. You'll meet him at the farmer's market. Might be, yeah, he's the money man. Yeah, yeah, he might be a little bit pushy sometimes, but we're teaching him skills and interactions.
Sure.
Yeah, so, and he also loves to help roast. Mm. He's down there. He's becoming very good. I can see him, out of all my kids at this stage, he's the one that he is most interested in the process.
He has a good nose.
Yeah, yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. And he's good at selling coffee, too. He likes to listen to people what they want, and then he offers them something. But he often is trying to get out of his school and help dad roast. But I say, once you're done your school, you can come help me roast.
Well, that's... But you know, when I see a generation followed by another generation, which is doing some of the things that the previous generation did, it usually is a sign that the relationship is a good relationship.
Yeah, so, I hope so.
You keep them there. Yes.
Yeah, and they all have their strong suits. My daughter, Hannah, she's 13, and she's just fantastic with many things. I did a market last week, the Big Cheese in Armstrong, which is a really cool community thing, by the way.
Yes.
And I gave them both just huge hugs at the end because we were so busy. And I never once had to look for where the water was. She always had it boiling. She just did so much work that I didn't even see her doing because she was behind me. And so I was, yeah, very grateful for the kids and their involvement.
You mentioned earlier how transparency and certification and identifying the source of the coffee, and you established some principles that you're right, embedding in your business.
Yeah.
Why don't you just discuss those for a little bit?
Right. So I call it kind of a hierarchy of green coffee buying. So small coffee roasters rarely can buy directly from producers because they want a container coming to your country at the same time. Well, when you want fresh, you don't want a container if you're a small producer. So we rely on importers on one level or another. Apart from occasionally, you will be able to, there will be the odd green coffee grower that will ship you small amounts. Right. And so I want transparency if you think at the top of the list, that's my number one thing is I want transparency.
So people know where it's coming from.
They know where it's coming from. The farm isn't holding secrets. You can see what they're doing. Some of them have some cool social programs, which I'm happy to support with, you know, clean water for the community. Some of them run schools, some of them run orphanages. And so that's a really important thing. Mm-hmm. But I know certifications are really important to some people. So so if you think Rainforest Alliance, or of course Certified Organic, as well as there's all kinds. I have a Colombian coffee on my website that has the Smithsonian Migratory Bird certification. I didn't know that existed. It's kind of interesting. So certifications are second, but a fairly close second.
Yep.
So in the perfect world, all my coffee would have great transparency and great certifications. But the truth of the matter is, if it doesn't have that organic label on it, they cannot claim to be organic. However, I would gladly tell you where I got this bean from.
And you can judge for yourself.
And you can judge for yourself because many of these farms, this is second, third, fourth, fifth generation farms. They're treating this land very well.
And they would have started their businesses or their operations before there were pesticides.
That's right.
So they've got plants that will survive without the aid of pesticides.
Right, yes. Yeah.
And freshness, that's another thing that you have made critical.
Right, so as a new coffee roaster when I was starting commercially, the bakery cafe in Piccadilly Mall, Sweet Leaf, was just, they've been awesome to deal with. And they got one batch that they didn't like quite as much. And they kind of reached out to me and said, hey, what's going on with this? And it caused me to learn something that I hadn't known before, in the fact that the green coffee freshness makes a huge difference. Mm. So if your green coffee has been harvested and landed for a year or a year and a half, 2 years, like I said on the phone, green coffee won't actually go bad. Like, it's not going to make you sick if it's stored well, but it doesn't taste as good.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I aim to try to get as the freshest green coffee as possible. The Ethiopians and Eastern African coffees start arriving in North America in June, July, August. So you have really nice, fresh up until October. But then after that, you're going to end up with the coffees are going to be a little bit older. They're not going to be bad. They're just not going to be as bright and just that real flavorful, different cup of coffee.
And that's the thing that you described when you first tried this coffee that your work was doing. It was a more challenging, interesting, complex sort of flavor.
Yeah, there's so many things that impact the final cup.
David, when I said at the beginning of the show, people listening are going to learn a lot about coffee and how it's grown and how it's processed and how it gets onto the table. I don't think I was making anything up. I think that's exactly what's happened today. And I think if people know these kinds of things about the food, or in this case, the beverage that they're consuming, it really makes a huge difference. And a farmer's market is a wonderful place to have people hearing about that.
Right.
I want to thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for sharing your very practical, very down-to-earth, but pretty detailed knowledge of this particular product that, as you say, just about everybody in the world these days consumes. And I would say there's a lot of people who would wish you well in your business, because it's the kind of business that was necessary in a town like this. Great. Thank you for being with us today.
Okay, thank you so much.